You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, Ken Buttigan shares the exciting news about the Nonviolence and Just Peace Conference at the Vatican, and what throwing out 1,700 years of just war theory might mean for the Catholic Church and the whole world.
Well, if Pope Francis actually calls for ending just war, and therefore withdraws consent from military systems globally, this will make his call for ending destruction of the planet through the environment actually a very small thing, because what we're talking about is a paradigm shift. And if the church has been propping up systems of war and oppression for 1700 years and begins to withdraw its consent from that, there, it won't just be a rift, it will be seismic.
With God stood before you with her hands on her hips, she said, I'll accept nothing but loving words from your lips. She said, everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be
Hello, this is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Aguanu, Golazik Gowolba, welcome and greetings to you in my native language. I'm coming to you from my home in the Don Land in Bunawabskeg territory in and along the shores of the magnificent Penobscot River in central Maine. And I'm joined today by my snake-charming and amazing co-host, Mr. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Hi, Sherry. I think we should just explain to the listeners that here in the Earthship of the desert of Taos, New Mexico, the Earthship is the kind of house I live in, the 6 foot or 5 foot long bull snakes, who are totally harmless, they're not poisonous whatsoever, they tend to come in the spring and, you know, do a little territorial dance around, which I engage in nonviolently. And we rework our territorial negotiations the same way as we do every year, meaning they stay outside, I stay inside. But most recently, I have had to catch one with my gloved hands and bring it outdoors. It was very calm. I was not so calm. But that's the rite of spring around here. Lots of bursting open of flowers on our fruit trees and a warming of the weather and changes of all kinds. You know, we have a really exciting guest on our show this week. Ken Buttigan, who I work with Campaign Nonviolence in Pace Bene, just got back from the Vatican in Rome, where he had helped to organize a conference called Nonviolence and Just Peace Conference, contributing to the Catholic understanding of and commitment to nonviolence, that was really quite significant and very profound, and may actually have quite a big impact on our world. So I won't give you any more than that teaser right now, but you should know that Ken was not only attending the conference, he was also part of the planning committee, and he was also coordinator for the program of the conference, and he coordinated the writing committee for the final draft of what came out of the conference and was sent to Pope Francis from these thinkers and leaders on peace and nonviolence. So, welcome to the show, Ken.
Well, thank you so much, Rivera. It's wonderful to be with you and with you, Sherry. And it was exciting to be in Rome, April 11th through the 13th, where I joined 84 other lay people, theologians, members of religious congregations, priests, and 5 bishops who traveled to this conference from Africa, from the Americas, from Asia, from across Europe, from the Middle East, and from Oceania, including Australia. And we were gathered to partake in, what we believed would be a landmark gathering. And in fact, I think that's proven to be the case. So we, most of us, participate in or work in contexts of extreme violence and injustice. And we came to Rome hoping, calling for, praying for, seeking a bold new direction from the global church on nonviolence. And so I'd like to say a little bit about that, what we were trying to do. And basically in March of 2015, I joined this planning committee that had started to get pulled together with agents of change out of the Catholic context all around the planet. We're very excited at the initiatives of Pope Francis around climate change, around challenging capitalism and economic injustice. And he has also said that faith and violence are incompatible. Well, if faith and violence are incompatible, then faith and nonviolence are compatible. And ever since Pope Francis was installed, and it's only been 3 years, in 2013, some of us began dreaming that this leader of the global Catholic Church would take steps, first of all, to confess its violence, but secondly, to say, Jesus really meant it when he said, love your enemies, create a nonviolent order where everyone matters. And so we began dreaming that this Pope might be open to writing an encyclical or a major church document that recentered the church in the nonviolence of Jesus, called for us to again see that this was central to the vision of Jesus and therefore is central to the mission of the church. So we came hoping to both call for a major document, but one that would be very punctuated with specific calls, including that every level of the church would practice nonviolence, train for nonviolence, integrated into religious services, integrated into the formation of the community, and then become peace and justice centers for the neighborhood, for the city, for the nation that people are in, and then for the planet. And we saw with this Pope a call for environmental restorative justice that he issued last year. And that's called an encyclical on the environment. And that has had an impact way beyond the Catholic Church. And we're hoping for the same thing with this Pope. And so we came to Rome, first of all, to reflect on our own experiences of nonviolence. And those were extremely powerful, to hear from people in East Africa, to hear from people from throughout Latin America, to hear from people in the Middle East, and in Asia, for example, in Mindanao, in the Philippines, to talk about their particular experiences of extreme violence, but also grappling with those in light of a call to extreme love or nonviolence in action. And so we heard from each other our perspectives and our experiences. Then we spent a whole session looking at Jesus in nonviolence and reclaiming a tradition that's really been lost for the last 1,700 years in terms of really saying that's at the heart of the tradition. Thirdly, to look at what a just peace as opposed to a just war would look like. And finally, we really did grapple with just war and to say, as we said in our final statement, there is no just war, and we called on the church to neither teach nor use the just war theory. It was a powerful experience, and even in the week or so since we've gotten back, we're starting to see some motion, including yesterday in the Sunday Times in London. Cardinal Turkson, who is the president of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, which co-sponsored this conference at the Vatican, So it's an arm of the Vatican. And Cardinal Turkson was interviewed in the Sunday Times in London. That's April 24th edition of the Sunday Times. And in the article, it said, he said the discussions now underway in the Vatican could lead to a papal encyclical setting out new teaching on violence. And there were a lot of positive things that the cardinal said. Well, the cardinal opened our conference with a powerful message from Pope Francis, where he said, your thoughts, this is the quote, your thoughts on revitalizing the tools of nonviolence and of active nonviolence in particular will be a needed and positive contribution. But not only did he bring that message from the Pope, he was part of our conference. And it was so amazing to see him playing a role in the final consensus, where 85 of us tried to get consensus on a final document. And he was actively involved in that and has was supportive of it. And so we're excited that there are some green lights for seeing this change. It won't happen overnight, but some of us are going to be involved in helping to both spread the word about it and to invite us to go on a roadmap to that kind of encyclical and the impacts that it can have on the larger church and world.
Ken, I've had the opportunity to work with Pax Christi here and have been a keynote speaker for them a couple of times and worked with them to draft a document to the Pope requesting the denouncement of the doctrine of discovery. And I also spoke on a panel put together by the Main Council of Churches on the Pope's environmental encyclical. And in that, there are a lot of really pretty words. But in order for any type of truth to guide us, it has to be more than pretty words. It has to be translated into a functional way of life. Unfortunately, what happened with the environmental encyclical is that it came out and there was a lot of stir about it. People were excited to hear about the Pope's position. But there are two events that took place immediately following that when he visited the United States that contradicted the ideas of healing and unity presented in that encyclical. First, in his speech to Congress, he compared the work of Congress to the work of the biblical leader Moses. And, you know, just prior to that, Prime Minister Netanyahu also stood in front of Congress to speak of his fears regarding a pending nuclear deal that the United States was negotiating with Iran. In his speech, Netanyahu offered to share the covenant of God as established with Israel, with the United States. And so this whole idea of a promised land and chosen people are troubling because you don't have to look too far into it to recognize that promised lands, for one, are often translated into ordained genocide for another. Another thing that he did was he canonized Junipero Serra, despite massive outcries by indigenous peoples and countless allies. The man was known for committing horrific crimes of genocide against indigenous peoples of this land. And so we all know that this has been a long journey for the past 1,700 years. Christians have waged war, led crusades. They've burned women at the stake, persecuted Jews and Muslims, kept slaves, blessed conquest as a noble act, prayed for successful war missions, bombing missions. So my question to you is, how do you expect this to actually create changes in the world that are practical and functional beyond just some pretty words on a page?
Well, these are all very, very important questions. One of the things that we integrated into the final document is, as we say, clearly the word of God, the witness of Jesus, should never be used to justify violence, injustice, or war. We confess that the people of God have betrayed this central message of the gospel many times, participating in wars, persecutions, oppression, exploitation, and discrimination. And so, first of all, for any kind of spreading of nonviolence in the church, as we know in our own lives or in our communities, there is the need to take responsibility for the ways we have perpetrated a violence. And that will be part of this process. We are seeing the need for this to be authentic, for the church to both recognize its own violence and those of us who are members of the church, our violence and injustice and our history of that and the impacts that that's had on real people and communities and whole continents. So there is a lot of amends and restorative justice that's going to be necessary for this to have the teeth that you're talking about. And some of us who have been spending our lives engaged with nonviolence and working to challenge and transform very specific policies and conditions of violence, including an overall domination system, who are part of this process, we want to see that happen in this church as well as everywhere else. So that's the first thing I'd say. None of us condones the violence of the church. In fact, we're drawn by this message of a nonviolent order that Jesus proclaimed and bet his life on to speak up and respond and to take this action to call on the church to nonviolence. The pretty words, of course, that's always the risk. I think the words we got in the statement, I hope you've read it, this two-page statement, I think they have the potential for the kind of impact that we're talking about, because they weren't generalities. They were very concrete efforts. Many of us who are involved in this are part of movements. We've been building movements forever. And for this to not only for these pretty words to be translated into a viable teaching of the church, but also to see it activated, will require an enormous amount of organizing and movement building, simply to get the document, which we do not have yet. But secondly, more importantly, when we do have a document, and I think we will get there, my guess is we will get that kind of bold teaching, that it will mean all kinds of activation. What I understand is that there wasn't enough development of how this was going to be implemented in terms of the environmental encyclical. And I see the work of the next few years on this as being, how do we actually begin to put in place actual concrete ways for the church to not only make a statement, but also to actually live this and to practice it. And that's going to take a huge amount of, at every level of the church, to see training and education and action. So, for example, here in Chicago, where I live, I've been working with the Chicago Archdiocese for the last few years on something called Catholics for Nonviolence. And when you're not at the global level, but you're in a particular diocese or region of the church, you see very clearly that it's a slow process of rebuilding. But that's the hope here. So I think it's right to question both motivation and where this could go, and will it just be an elegant statement? I think that's absolutely right in light of the glaring forms of injustice that you mentioned and that are way beyond what you mentioned. At the same time, I think it's an opportunity for that kind of both confession and reconciliation that nonviolence invites us to.
Ken, I want to just ask a few questions about the conference and the statement that came out of it. One has to do with the common misunderstanding that nonviolence and peace equate to passivity. And one of the things about the conference that was very heartening for me to see is that it wasn't just your typical peace activists at this conference. You mentioned people from around the world, but there were a few key figures that I'd like to point out. One, John Deere was there, who's an infamous peace activist here in the U.S., but also Maria Steffen, the co-author of Why Civil Resistance Works, one of the groundbreaking studies on the empirical data around nonviolent action and nonviolent struggle. And it's incredible startling history in the past 100 years and why that's so hopeful for all of us. But also there were many representatives there who have done international nonviolent peace force work or unarmed peacekeeping, this growing field of using nonviolent action to build and maintain peace all around the world that is becoming one of the most viable options in terms of international security and receiving enormous funding right now from governments overseas because it is so successful. Now, the key thing about bringing up these people for me is that the conference and this document both are going beyond the usual platitudes of the words peace and nonviolence and digging into the incredible viable fields of applications that exist. Would you care to say more about some of those dimensions and how they were reflected in the final document?
I sure would. Thanks, Rivera. So, for 1700 years, the Catholic Church has promoted the just war theory, has said that there's a right to use armed violence in certain circumstances. And most of the time, that is based on some pragmatic evaluation that, well, in the face of a particular invasion or in a particular situation of violence, only violence will work. And therefore, even though Jesus says, love your enemies, it's licit, it's okay to use violence, and it's actually supported by the church. And that's led to holy war and crusades and the conquering of many parts of the world and oppression. And so we wanted to take that theory head on and say, first of all, there's no basis in the founding vision of the tradition for a just war. But also, in addition to that, we now know that there are innumerable nonviolent alternatives to grapple with situations of violence and injustice nonviolently. So in our document, we propose or we lift up a tradition that's begun to emerge called just peace, and that includes promoting nonviolent practices and strategies, nonviolent resistance, and this is in our document. And I suspect this is the first document from a papal or from a Vatican conference that has included these words: nonviolent resistance, restorative justice, trauma healing, unarmed civilian protection, conflict transformation, and of peace-building strategies. And so what we very seriously examined through the work of people like Maria Stephan, but also the work of particular peace-builders from across the globe who have been in situations of extreme violence and have concluded that violent strategies, either to end violence or to somehow make peace, don't work. So, for example, we were privileged to have with us Bishop Taban from South Sudan, who himself was captured by a rebel group, was held, probably, very likely would have been killed. He described in excruciating detail both the danger he was in, but also how he created a relationship with his captors, changed the dynamic of their relationship. He was eventually freed. The only people the rebels would agree to in terms of a mediator, and the only person the government would agree to as a mediator, was Bishop Taban. And they went on to develop a peace accord. We heard many stories of people who have faced extreme violence, who have decided a nonviolent approach, difficult, challenging. It's those two hands of nonviolence. I will not cooperate with your injustice, but I'm open to you as a human being. We heard one story after another in the Middle East, in Asia, in Latin America, in Africa, and even some of the stories from the resistance some of us have been part of here in the United States and in Europe. So what was heartening about this conference was, one, We were rooting this in our experience too. We were offering a lens for actually seeing what did Jesus say. Number three, we wanted to really look at an alternative to just war that was just and effective. Because when you go along with just war, then that your thinking in terms of nonviolent strategies or alternatives is it atrophies, and it lets us off the hook in a certain way. And of course, so many people suffer because of it. So I was very heartened by the fact that this was the direction of where we were going.
I've been very interested to read some of the commentary that's come out of the conference. There have been a number of folks who have written about it, including John Deere, Erica Chenoweth. One of the things that struck me that I was curious, and I'm still curious about how this is going to unfold, is there's been this really cozy, romantic relationship between religion and war, as we've said, for 17 centuries. And religion has been largely used to help promote war. So this shift that you're talking about is going to require a complete decolonization of the mind. For 17 centuries, it has been part of not only religious but social gospel. It has become part of the marketing scheme for the industry that war has become. And I'm wondering, because there are so many things here that I want to talk about. I mean, I want to talk about the fact that there are many who say this just isn't going to be possible, because we've been led to believe for so long that war and aggression and violence is the only way to solve these problems. And that's where we've put all of our money. And it has developed into a huge industry. But the fact of the matter is that we've never put any real money into examining alternatives to armed aggression to see what that can do on a real broad basis. As we know, it's had some incredible success over the years in areas where mostly folks have volunteered their time to go in and to address these issues just out of their own moral conviction. So how do you think this is going to unfold when we have a huge military-industrial complex that has largely leaned on and used the church as part of its propagation and spin under these concepts of just war? Is there going to be a rift there? How will you manage that rift when those who have romanticized and used just war theory to validate their actions are now potentially going to be attacking the church for their position?
Thanks, Sherry. If the document that we came to is translated into both an encyclical and a program to integrate this in the life of the Catholic Church at every level, if that happens, it's seismic. I read a blog a couple of days after our conference ended, and somebody said, well, if Pope Francis actually now calls for ending just war and therefore withdraws consent from military systems globally, this will make his call for ending destruction of the planet through the environment actually practically a very small thing, because this is what we're talking about, is a paradigm shift. And if the church has been, as you say, propping up systems of war and oppression for 1700 years and begins to withdraw its consent from that, this will lead to huge backlash. There, it won't just be a rift, it will be seismic. It will be a tsunami of pushback worldwide.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence.
What is this hole in the universe? In my mind, what is this break in the holy verse? Of all time, what is this pole in the universe? In my mind, what is this break in the holy verse? Of all time, of all time, time, of all time.
On this week's Nonviolent Minute, we're going to take a look at Pax Christi. Pax Christi is the peace-keeping arm of the Catholic Church, and it is Latin for Peace of Christ. This organization was established in France in 1945 by two French citizens who were interested in reconciliation between the French and Germans in the aftermath of World War II. Some of the first actions of Pax Christi were the organization of peace pilgrimages and other actions fostering reconciliation between France and Germany. Although Pax Christi initially began as a movement for French-German reconciliation, it expanded its focus and spread to other European countries in the 1950s and grew as a crusade of prayer for peace among all nations. In 1952, Pax Christi was recognized as the official international Catholic peace movement by Pope Pius XII. Pax Christi focuses on five main issues: human rights, human security, disarmament and demilitarization, just world order, religion, and peace. Members of the group are committed to encountering and responding to the issues facing the world today through prayer, study, and action. The work of members takes on many forms. It can range from open dialogue and discussion on peace and spirituality in their lives to participating in anti-war actions on the streets of the world's capitals. It can be the struggle against the illicit sale of arms through active support of international actions to control arms sales, and it can be simply raising awareness about human rights issues through letter-writing campaigns, speeches, or meetings with the communities and governments where Pax Christi member organizations are found. And other times, it's raising the standard of living for people in their own community through social development projects and training programs. Their reach is broad and their view is long. Today on the show, we're talking about a move to end the just war theory of the Catholic Church. It's an exciting development, but as you can see, it's not a new idea. It appears to be a culmination of decades of work by those from within the Church to change the philosophical standing of the Church in regard to war. The way this discussion around ending the just war theory unfolds and how it ends up translating into a workable plan of action will be up to each one of us, whether we're members of the Church or not. The first step is for us to ask ourselves, are we ready to unlearn all of our indoctrination around war? Are we ready to decolonize our minds and shift our hearts back to a position of love? We're certainly ready for that here on Love and Revolution Radio, and we're very thankful to know that each one of you is here with us.
There's a pattern in my mind. I think it's been there for all time. It's like a geometric prayer. I can just barely sense it there.
Our featured music this week is called Song of Time from Diane Patterson's new album, Teach, Inspire, Be Real. We are particularly excited about this new album since it is the first available recording of our theme song, Love and Revolution. Next week we're going to have Diane here with us on the show to discuss art, making change, and music. In the meantime, you can find her music at www.dianepatterson.org. And now, let's return to our program.
What we're lifting up is that the Church has maintained, in contrast to the vision of Jesus, has maintained the myth of redemptive violence. And that's not just a policy or an issue or a condition. That is, as you say, a state of mind. And we are calling on ourselves and the larger Church to have that total transformation of mind that way. So I think it won't happen immediately, but the implications, the logic of what we wrote and what was applauded by Cardinal Turkson, and we will see, but it seems like we're in the direction of, from the Vatican, of an encyclical along these lines. The power of that will be a huge discussion about where we go as a planet. Do we go the way of violence, continue along the path of violence, or of nonviolence? So truth passes through three phases. First, it's ridiculed. Secondly, it is fiercely and violently opposed. And third, it becomes self-evident. And we expect this to be trivialized and mocked and laughed at. But then the second phase, when it really sinks in that this is what Pope Francis is calling for, there will be huge violent response, emotional, verbal, physical, institutional, and social structural. It will be a huge social struggle. It may go on for decades or even centuries, I don't know. But from our perspective, it's time to make this shift so that we can get to the third phase, which it becomes self-evident that inflicting harm, violence, domination, and destruction on one another is actually not what we're called to do as a planet. So where on the planet can we go to raise the moral vision of this? Well, there are lots of places, but we felt that, first of all, it was important for the church that some of us are part of to actually stand up and say it was actually supposed to be nonviolent all along. But then secondly, the potential impact for this kind of statement, and not only that, way of life, would be probably magnified if it came out of the Vatican in this way. And it's not to say that's the only place. But will that create a huge tempest? Yes. Just like in Birmingham in 1963, when nonviolent activists challenged Jim Crow white racism and supremacy, it created this huge conflict. Of course, Dr. King said the conflict was there already, and he was just bringing it out. And that's I think, what we're going to be doing here. So answering your question, yes, if the logic of this statement is seen for what it is, that will happen. But I think that's part of the nonviolent transformation that does have to happen.
Ken, that's very interesting that you made that comparison to Birmingham and how Dr. King said the conflict existed all along and what they were doing is dramatizing the conflict. I think there's a real parallel to that in the Catholic Church. While it's almost converse of what was going on in Jim Crow South, which is that the violence of the Catholic Church is self-evident. It's very obvious and has a long historic record, as Sherry summarized very neatly at the beginning of the show. What isn't as known to Catholics and to others is the long tradition of resisting war and violence. And it's interesting that you're proposing this to Pope Francis, because Saint Francis, for whom he is named, or took the name, also turned his back on war and imperialism and the military-industrial complex of his era in Assisi, and actually committed to a path of peace and nonviolence in a time when that was almost unthinkable. I was wondering if you would give us a little historical context about the thin thread through the Catholic Church of these courageous dissenting voices who have always said what we are doing as a church is completely and utterly wrong.
Right. So for the first three centuries of Christianity, it was programmatically nonviolent. They actually took Jesus seriously and at his word, and at high cost for many people who, in taking that stance, faced oppression and persecution and even martyrdom. So that was the first three centuries. And then with the coming of Constantine, who legalized Christianity, and then eventually the Roman Empire deemed Christianity the official religion of the empire, then you begin to see cozying up to military dictatorship and empire and theologies tailored to that, like the just war theory, and then eventually holy war theory with the Crusades and so on. But as you say, at the same time, there were powerful, there was a not even a thin thread. It was just not seen very well, but there was a thread of nonviolent activists, communities, peoples, even before St. Francis, who said Jesus's nonviolence, his determined peaceableness, was the heart of the matter. So we, for example, John Deere and I wrote a paper. We had a wonderful series of background papers for the conference that we asked everybody to dip into. And we wrote a paper on, called An Overview of Gospel Nonviolence in the Christian Tradition. And in this paper, we laid out what we saw as the threads of that kind of anti-violence tradition. So, for example, not a single Christian writing exists before the early 4th century supporting Christian participation in warfare. And then after Constantine, there's a whole series of people who say, actually, I'm being called to fight in war, but actually I'm a follower of Christ and I can't do that. One of the most famous was St. Maximilian, who was 21 years old and who refused conscription in the Roman army. And at his trial, and we have his transcript of his trial, he says, I cannot serve, I cannot do evil. And that was read in the Catholic Mass for centuries after that. There are a series of communities and traditions through the years, and I could just highlight a few. St. Martin of Tours was an officer in the Roman army, and after his conversion, he left the military, but they said, we'll fix you, and put him in the front lines of the battle. And the opposing army came up, and they said a miracle was performed where they were so befuddled, they turned around and ran off. I like to interpret that they saw an unarmed person there, and that's not part of their way of fighting, to actually attack somebody unarmed, and it had this impact. Anyway, there are a series of things that we don't have time to go into, but certainly in the 20th century, with the emergence of the Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker Movement, Franz Jagerstatter in World War II, who rather than being conscripted into the Nazi military, refused. He said that had nothing to do with Jesus' teachings in the Sermon on the Mount, and he was tried and executed. And of course, Thomas Merton in this country was key in the teachings on nonviolence, and then Oscar Romero in El Salvador. But the greatest example for me was Cardinal Sin in Manila, who was facing the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos in the 1980s, and said, is there an alternative to passivity on the one hand or armed struggle on the other? Because people were saying, this military dictatorship will not end without an armed struggle. And they said, well, it'll take 10 years and 10,000 people will die, but at least we'll get rid of this military dictatorship. And what they did was three Catholic sisters came to the cardinal and said, well, why don't you bring the International Fellowship for Reconciliation trainers here and lead a training and see what they have to say about nonviolence as a third way. They did for 3 days. And at the end, the cardinal said, we've got to get this training out everywhere. And they got that out all across in hundreds of trainings on many of the islands of the Philippines. They did not know they were being prepared for the moment when Marcos would try to steal the election in February of 1986. And when they did that, those thousands of people who had been trained in nonviolence organized 2 million people to come into the streets of Manila. And within 4 days, Marcos was on a plane out of the country. And there's so many incredible stories of nonviolent action that happened there. And I see that potential for that kind of standing up to the military, being trained, a call to civil disobedience, which is what Cardinal Sin did from every pulpit across the country. So we're hoping that kind of transforming practice, training, preaching, slowly begins to create an alternative to a system of domination across the planet, there will be pushback. But we will be trained for that and face the costly but, we hope, powerful response to that.
It's such a powerful image to consider the possibilities that could unfold if this ends up becoming what we all hope that it will become. To think of those who are currently in the military refusing to commit any harm against another. To think of those who are engaged in weapons manufacturing to disengage from those activities, because that industry, the military-industrial industry, is reliant upon the people that hold those positions. It's certainly not the CEOs who are out there on the front line who are engaged in warfare. It's certainly not them in the factories that are making these weapons or transporting them or selling them. And so when we think about the power that we have as people and think about the ability that we have to be able to just stop cooperating with violent industrial practices and thinking about on a global scale the type of impact that that can have, it's really exciting to me. It's really inspiring. And what are some of the practical things that you see people being willing and able to do to actually make that become a reality in some way?
Thank you. My own experience is that, as you say, the mind has been colonized. We have to create spaces where people get to try on this alternative way of looking at the world. And as somebody who's led hundreds of nonviolence trainings in this country and around the world, I've been so privileged to hold the space for people to go through that kind of shift in their own thinking. So one thing I think is really important is nonviolence training, nonviolence education that invites people to grapple with the violence in their own lives that they have been survivors of or that they have been perpetrators of, but also to say we have more power than we think to create an alternative to passivity or violence. So in terms of this work with the Catholic Church, my vision is that hundreds of thousands of those trainings would happen in every parish, in every diocese, in every archdiocese, in every country, in every continent, that those long-term efforts to reframe, retrain, see differently, that will really, really bear fruit. Secondly, I think in terms of the church, where is the preaching on nonviolence? Where is the integration into the daily life of a particular congregation or parish? Those things could dramatically change. So in Chicago, we have been saying we want to create a training team for every what's called a vicariate or a section of the archdiocese, which is it's actually a very large archdiocese, that would work with each parish to do a nonviolence assessment. To what extent are we really putting the words of Jesus into practice? How is that impacting our homilies on Sundays or the way we work with people around the violence that they're experiencing? How do we create resources for that? Right now, virtually none of that exists. And we are actually hoping in this bold moment that if there is an encyclical, if there is a way of really calling for this kind of thing, it could begin to influence and infiltrate the church. And it's not something alien. It's actually the roots and the vision of the church itself that we're recommitting to. Now, if we don't get an encyclical, we're going to do this work anyway. And some of us have been part of Campaign Nonviolence at Pace Bene, which goes beyond the church. It's really calling all of us around the planet to grapple with that colonization of our minds, of our communities, of our cities, of our nations. And let's build a culture of peace and nonviolence that works for everyone, where we're free from war, poverty, racism, climate destruction, and just the plain old epidemic of violence. It's going to take a long time to do it, but what a powerful moment. And I would say this, we're at a turning point. I see this for the church, but I see it way beyond the church as well. So I want to go in the direction of nonviolence, justice, peace, sustainability. I want to go in that direction. And I think a lot of people do. So what we're trying to do is open the opportunities for all of us to take, you know, one step forward, 87 steps back, so that we can actually start moving in this direction.
Ken, I think it's great that you shared a little bit about Campaign Nonviolence and the fact that it includes people's faith and people of all faith, but broadens beyond that, including the Nonviolent Cities Project, which looks at the city as the model for transforming the systems and structures of violence that we're a part of. And also, you know, we talk a lot about creating nonviolent schools, creating nonviolent ways of producing the foods and the goods that we need. The nonviolence extends beyond just our interpersonal relations into things like living wages, renewable energy. Just as you were saying about the conversation at the Rome conference, nonviolence goes from the big and the metaphorical and the philosophical right down into the nuts and bolts of the very tangible, very practical, and very applicable formats of it in the world. In our last few minutes of the show, I was wondering if you would discuss a little bit the other phrase in the conference, the Nonviolence and Just Peace Conference, and what is just peace? There's also a construct of negative and positive peace, where negative peace is when your whole community looks like it's all peaceful, but actually there's deep injustice and oppression seething beneath the surface of it. And that's actually the kind of peace that most of us as Americans live in, this negative peace. If we have even a semblance of peace at all, many of our communities don't. But for those of us that live free from the immediate forms of physical violence, are often living sheltered and protected by the systemic and structural violences that provide that kind of privilege in the world. In the term just peace, are you dealing with the concept that there are some kinds of peace that are not just?
Well, yes. I mean, of course, if we go back to the Roman Empire and Pax Romana, that idea of peace was bought at the expense of domination across the then known world, as far as the Romans were concerned. So it was the peace enforced by militarism. It was the peace of the graveyard. Just peace is this powerful, as you say, positive vision where we get what we need, where the deep needs are met, where we are affirming the infinite worth of every person, and it's in contradistinction to this narrow notion of peace. And part of that's also to fill out this notion of nonviolence, that it's not simply the absence of violence. It is this powerful, full experience of life. As Dr. King defined nonviolence, it's the love that does justice. And so this power of overwhelming love, concretely present in our relationships, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our world. So one of the things I heard at the conference from one of the participants from the Philippines was that after Marcos was deposed in 1986, the Philippines national government instituted peace education in every school in the country. Peace education in every school of the in the country. And the person reported that now throughout civil society, this training is starting to have its impact because everybody gets a vision and toolbox of just peace, essentially. And so when we ask what does it mean? It means we're getting that training, developmentally appropriate training as we're growing up. We're creating the infrastructure that says that if food deserts exist in the city, that's got to end. So we've got to work to develop the infrastructure so in any part of our cities that does not happen. I just taught a class where students connected, were designing a way to respond to that, and they connected local hospitals who are in the business of health with urban farming, which is also another form of health, and how could they two work together so that they eliminate food deserts in places where they exist. For example, this is just one example of what a just peace would look like. In fact, John Paul Lederach, one of the great practitioners and theorists of nonviolence, who teaches at Notre Dame University, talks about just peace being one word. Just peace. And so you can't really talk about peace without justice. And you can't really talk about justice without peace. And so we're actually trying to smush those together more.
I'd like to remind you, listeners, that we are speaking today with Ken Buttigan, who is the director of Pace Bene, Campaign Nonviolence. He was also one of the coordinators of the Just Peace Conference in Rome. Ken, it's been such an honor to speak with you today, and it's been an inspiration to hear about the vision that all of those participating have for this movement going forward, which is essentially the mission that many of us out here doing this work in other parts of the world share with you. We only have a few minutes left. Can you share with us your final thoughts, things you'd like our listeners to think about as they move forward?
Thank you, Sherry, and thank you, Rivera, for all the work that you're doing for a world that works for all of us. I do this work because my brother Larry died on the streets, a homeless person. And I don't want to see anyone treated the way my brother was. I want a world where everyone is seen as beautiful and of infinite worth. And we can all be part of a movement to build a world like that, a world of nonviolence and just peace, a world where we are able to both create peace, justice, sustainability, and practice it and be creating a culture that carries that out and sustains it. And I've been very fortunate to see that work. And I invite all of us to meditate on the fact that we all have more power than we think to create such a beautiful, powerful world. It's not easy. It's risky. It's difficult. It takes courage. But I know we're up to it. And I've seen it in action in the lives of many people. And we're going to need that as we come to the crossroads in this time. So I really appreciate all the work you're doing, Sherry, and all you're doing, Rivera, to help make that a reality. And I invite everyone across the planet to do so as well.
Thanks this week to our guest, Ken Buttigan, and my wonderful co-host, Sherry Mitchell. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson, and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find this song and more of her great music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd like to thank my amazing co-host, Mr. Vera Sun, for today's engaging conversation about a subject matter that impacts us all. If you enjoyed this show, you might also enjoy the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. Ken Buttigan found a way to bring his vision for a culture of nonviolence and just peace straight into the heart of his faith, the Catholic Church. Perhaps, listeners, you'll discover where and how you can boldly bring nonviolence by the time we talk to you next week.